Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
And now they're here. Really? That was it? Great enthusiasm. That's the kind of enthusiasm we're looking for.
See what happens when you go out of town.
Yeah, like a lot of things happened when I went out of town. First off, come here, young lady. Yeah, come here. Before I say anything else, we have to say goodbye to Charlie. Charlie leaves for China tomorrow, where she will be traveling with a medical group going into villages in the far remote areas of China, delivering medicine. And it is because of the kindness and generosity of the GCA folks and listeners online that she was able to raise enough money to go. She worked really hard, pulled a lot of overtime hours, and was able to raise most of the money. And then she said, it's just not enough. And you all collectively said, well, then it'll be enough, and you're going to go. So we're proud of Charlie, and we're going to miss her because she won't be sitting here playing violin with us. But keep her in your prayers while she's on the other side of the planet over there doing good work. And don't get caught and imprisoned or anything.
Right. That's another thing. It is a mission trip, so you know the Word of God will be preached, and that's going to be a little dangerous. But the worst that can happen is being exported, so, you know,
good.
For now.
Yes. We hope that's the worst that can happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But yes, I'm very, very excited. So I leave out tomorrow, and I'll be gone for about 2 weeks.
Come here. See this guy? Charlie was about this size when I met her. Okay, sit down. You're done.
That's the only rule.
I've watched Charlie grow up into the fine young lady you see standing in front of you, and I'm proud to send her as a representative, not only of little GCA, but of Christianity in America, over to China to go do some good work. So, God bless you. Come back to us.
Thank you.
Bye, Charlie!
I'm still here.
Remember to pray for Charlie. Now, mention was made momentarily ago, if that's actually a good English phrase, of the things that occurred while I was away. I missed 2 Sundays, and for 1 Sunday, the Tomites took over. That schism in the church began. All those people who were like, Tom, we want more Tom. Yay, Tom. And then last week, Barney Johnson was here. Now, I heard the recording. You all have to remember that even though I'm away, the internet exists. And Barney Johnson stood up and began by saying, I think this is the earliest I've ever stood up. Oh, and you all laughed. And then he said, well, that's because the pastor's gone. And when pastor's gone, you don't get all that other stuff. What other stuff? So, yes, collectively, you were all picking on the fact that I was gone. I had a great time in Texas. I taught Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night last week. So it was a lot of talking, a lot of lecturing. I taught the Sovereignty series, and it is on our website now if you go to the Listen link. And then you go to the Sovereignty of God folder, which has the original Sovereignty of God series in it. And then it has the Sovereignty series that we preached here. And then it has the highly compressed one subject a night preached in Dallas Sovereignty series there. So you can hear all of it on our website. And however, while I was in Texas, where it was 105 with very high humidity, I made the mistake one night of saying to the gathered congregation there that not everybody lived in 105 degrees because the rest of us figured out that there were options. And oh, how they laughed. And then the next day we saw that Smyrna, Tennessee was one of the hottest cities in America, where it was like, what, 112 or some absurd thing? And so Pastor Greg Wren down there at Saints Chapel in Mesquite, Texas, came over to me and said, so where are your options now? Well, apparently they're gone. So thank you very much to Tom. Thank you very much to Tim. Thank you very much to Barney for feeding the sheep and keeping the home fires burning while I was traveling. Thank you very much to Josh for playing piano in my absence. Appreciate you doing that. A round of applause for Josh. Good to see the young men stepping up, even if they're only doing it because their fathers made them. So we're glad for Wow, you got sympathy up here, Josh. You actually got, Turn to the book of Hebrews. We're continuing in the book of Hebrews. We're in Hebrews 5 today. We've been working our way verse by verse through the book. We're going to try to bite off a reasonably large section today, but I am aware that we're packed in tight today and that it's warm, so if at any point you all give up, just raise your hands and say, I give, and we'll just stop there. Chapter 5 of the book of Hebrews is a transitional kind of chapter. Starting in chapter 3:1, the author of the book of Hebrews introduced us to the concept and said, let us consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, our homologeo, our same words that we as Christians are all supposed to be saying. He said, let us consider Christ, who is our apostle, our high priest. And then throughout chapter 3 and chapter 4, he's been talking about the superiority of Christ over the other high priests, the priesthood of the Levites, the priesthood of Aaron. And he's going to continue that theme as we get into chapter 5, but then by the time we get done with chapter 5 and the early part of chapter 6, he's going to tell his readers, his Hebrew audience, remember always that this is a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, so we always have to read it through that lens, through that understanding. He then tells his audience that they should have been grown up enough, they should have been mature enough by now, that they were able to move on into a deeper theology, into a more fully orbed, more complete, sound doctrine. But because they were continuing to waver between their full commitment to Christ and their desire to return to the law and the ways of the historic Hebrew religion, he has to go back and keep replanting the same essentials. And he's going to identify the essentials for us and say that the essentials at the beginning of chapter 6 are going to be things like repentance. And that's going to be very, very important in understanding the controversy in chapter 6, which we'll get to in a week or two. One of the passages that is most difficult and one that makes a lot of people stumble, but you have to understand that it is the decided purpose of the writer of the book of Hebrews to move at that point into a sound theology that he admits is difficult. And so we're going to have to take our time when we work through that. Chapter 5 is going to begin with, yet again, comparing Christ to the Old Testament priesthood. And we've really got to understand what the Old Testament priesthood was about in order to understand the superiority of Christ in that priesthood. The priesthood of Christ is so far superior to the Aaron priesthood, to the Levitical priesthood, that the writer of Hebrews is even going to say that it was established through a whole different lineage, because every Hebrew knows, every Jew knows, that the priesthood has to come out of the tribe of Levi, has to be a Levite to be a priest. Jesus was born of the tribe of Judah. Therefore, he doesn't qualify to be a priest or to work in the temple or certainly not to be high priest. And yet here the writer of Hebrews continues to insist that Jesus is the apostle and high priest of our profession. Well, in what way can he be a high priest? Well, he's going to answer that in chapter 5 as well, and tell us that he's of a completely different order. He's of the order of Melchizedek. He's going to bring that up twice in this chapter, and then in a couple of chapters, he's really going to dig into the details of the little passage we see back in the book of Genesis where Melchizedek shows up after Abraham has had his victory against the kings of the valleys. And we'll get into that deeper. All you need to know right now, all you need to hang on to right now, is that the writer of Hebrews is establishing that the priesthood that Jesus is part of is not the Levi priesthood, not the Aaron priesthood. He is a high priest through a completely different lineage, reaching all the way back to Melchizedek. And when we finally get to the writer of Hebrews explaining the relationship of Christ and Melchizedek in a couple of chapters, we're going to read things that are just really, really difficult to wrap your brain around, because he's going to say that Melchizedek had neither father or mother, didn't have any lineage, that back there he ever lives. He's going to use the kind of language that can only be understood if you see Melchizedek as a Christophany. There, I've thrown around a lot of big theological terminology. I hope you're all duly impressed. All that means is that Christ's priesthood is so superior to the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood that only he could be a part of it. If, in fact, Melchizedek is a Christophany, then the priesthood of Melchizedek to Christ is completely Christological, Christocentric. Christ begins it. Christ continues it. Christ perfects it. No man took any part in that priesthood. And that seems to be the argument that the writer of Hebrews is going for. So we'll get to all of that. He's about to dig into really, really important, very deep theology. But first, he wants to establish that every person on the planet necessarily needs a high priest. Now, think about that for a moment. We know all the way back in the book of Genesis that our problem when we stand before God is that we're sinful, we're depraved. We're dead in trespasses and sins, according to Ephesians 2. So we have nothing to recommend ourselves. We can't stand in front of the thrice holy God and argue our case, because we simply don't have anything with which to argue. We don't have any works we can bring. We don't have any internal holiness. We don't have any personal righteousness that we can take to God and say, save me on this basis. And even those couple of things that we might point to and say, well, but I did this, and this is kind of good. Isaiah pulls the rug out from under even that and tells us that all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. So you've got nothing you can take in front of God. And that's been the case ever since the fall in the garden. You have always needed some sort of intercessor between you and God. You can't stand before the righteous, holy God being you and expect for him to accept you. There has to be some kind of exchange made. And so God put in place this great exchange where he was willing in the Old Testament to receive the blood of bulls and goats and lambs. He was willing to receive that instead of the blood of the sinful person. And so the priests would do things like take sacrificial animals and then place their hands on the head of the animal as a sign of transference of guilt. And when the priest was dressed in the full high priest garb, he had the names of the 12 tribes of Israel as a weight on his shoulders. And he had a breastplate in gold with 12 precious stones with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. So he was standing there as a representative of national Israel, all 12 tribes. And then he would put his hands on the sacrificial animal, and that animal would shed its blood in exchange for the blood of the sinners of Israel. And God was willing to allow that exchange for 1,400 years. And blood flowed and flowed and flowed. It's one of the complaints, unfortunately, that people have about the Bible. The critics of the Bible will say, there's so much blood in the Bible. I had someone write to me once a couple of years ago and say, why is there so much blood in the Bible? And the answer is because there's so much sin among human beings. And that continual sinfulness on the part of Israel required the continual flow of blood. Because, get this right, in God's economy, when someone sins, someone dies. Always, starting all the way back at the Garden of Eden. Adam was told, you can eat from any tree in the garden, but you can't eat of that tree that's in the midst of the garden. The day that you eat of it, you will die. Which is interesting because Adam and Eve had no concept of death. They were formed out of the ground. They'd never seen anything die. God walks into an environment where everything is living and alive, and he speaks of death. And sure enough, Adam and Eve, the moment that they took from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they were in rebellion against God. And you remember what God did when he drove them out of the garden? Of course, they, realizing they were naked, got busy right away, sewed together some fig leaves to cover themselves up so that they could kind of go, no, we're good. They put their works in place. We're covered. We'll cover our nakedness. Maybe God won't notice. God comes walking in the cool of the day, so they hide with their fig leaves, hoping God won't notice. And God says, Adam, where are you? Not because God was looking for information, but he wanted Adam to have to admit that he was running and hiding. And Adam says, I hid from you because I was naked. And God says, who told you you were naked? Well, nobody had to tell him. He knew he was naked. Do you remember what God did about that? He put together animal skins to cover their nakedness, which means something died. He killed an animal and took the skin of the animal, the skin of the sacrifice, to cover the first sinners. As soon as there was a sinner, there was a sacrifice. There was intervention on behalf of the sinners. And this goes on throughout the Old Testament. Let me show you a quick example. I know you just turned to Hebrews and we haven't even dug in there yet, but keep your finger in Hebrews. Turn to the very end of the book of Job. The reason I make so many references to the book of Job is that it is demonstrably the oldest book in the Bible. Job is probably a contemporary of Abraham. But you read nothing in the book of Job about Israel or the temple or Abraham or Moses or any of that. It's a very, very, very early book. And yet there's a tremendous amount of theology in the book, including God's own defense of God's own sovereignty. God is very quick to defend the fact that he's in charge of everything. But at the very end of the book, chapter 42, and remember, this is one of the oldest books in the Bible.
It's the oldest, right?
I think arguably the oldest book in the Bible. We're going to start in chapter 42, verse 7. You know the story, the beginning of the book. Satan and God have a conversation about Job. Satan is allowed to touch Job, to touch his things. Kills his children, kills his cattle, destroys all that he has. Satan finally says, skin for skin, let me touch his skin and he'll curse you to your face. God is counting on Job's uprightness. And so he allows Satan to even touch him to the point where Job ends up sitting on an ash heap with a broken piece of pottery, cutting open the boils and sores on his body so that the pus can run out, after his children have all died and he's lost everything he's ever had. That's the condition in which we find Job. And Job's own wife comes to him and says, will you yet retain your integrity? Curse God and die. Thanks, dear. And what we see is that Job, throughout the book, maintains his integrity, maintains the position that he didn't do anything to cause this, but three friends show up. And the big middle section of the book of Job is all about his three friends trying to convince him, you must have done something. Just admit it. Just admit you did something, because God is just and God is right, and God would never just do this to somebody. That's way too sovereign. We can't imagine a God who just does things according to his own will and his own good pleasure, especially something as painful as this, Job. So admit you did it and that God is just reacting to you. And then, of course, you know the story. Finally, Job rises up and says, if God was here, I'd demand of him, and he'd answer me. And then God shows up and starts with, who is this that darkens my counsel without knowledge? Uh-oh. Quit you like a man, I will demand of you, you will answer me. And then he starts with, where were you when I did everything? And then he goes through the litany of all the things he does. Everything from thunder and ice and snow to creating the sweet influence of the Pleiades. I have no idea what that is. to creating the entire universe, to feeding baby birds, to knowing what time the baby lions are going to come around, to putting a hook in the jaw of Leviathan. He goes through the litany of all the things he does, and the whole time he keeps saying to Job, what have you done? Finally, he reaches the point where he says, so encase yourself in light and glory. Make yourself look like me. Bring down all the wicked. Bring down all the proud and humble them. And then I will admit to you that your own hand can save you. So this is the context in which we now read 47, verse 7. And it came about after the Lord had spoken those words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now that ought to send a chill through you. Here is God admitting right at the beginning, earliest book of the Bible, here he is right away saying, say what's right about me. And my wrath is kindled when you don't. So then it's incumbent on you to know what is right about God and make sure that what you're saying about God is what's right. But then look at what he does. They have to have an intercessor between them and God. They have now offended the righteous, holy God. And in order for them to be accepted before him and not die at his hand, they need an intercessor and a sacrifice. So verse 8 says, now therefore, take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams. There's the sacrifice. Go to my servant Job. There's the intercessor. And offer up a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job will pray for you. There's the intercessory work. For I will accept him so that I may not do with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. In other words, right away, very early in the Bible, once there is that rift between God and human beings, God himself has to place somebody between the sinner and himself. Some intercessor has to be there. And there has to be a sacrifice, and there has to be an intercessor. And that is the point of the priesthood. I said all that to say God establishes this very early on, and then once he codifies Israel as a nation at Mount Sinai, in the law, both in the book of Deuteronomy and in the Levitical law, he then establishes a system by which the Levites and the high priests will stand between sinful Israel and holy God and intercede for them. And for 1,400 years, that intercessory work includes blood, 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 because of all the sin, 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 sin. Now go back to the book of Hebrews. So when you read chapter 3, verse 1, now let's consider Jesus Christ, who is the apostle and high priest of our profession. When he uses the word high priest to this Hebrew audience, everything I just told you resonates in their memory. They know that the only way they've been able to approach God in the temple was through the work of a high priest. And now Jesus is referred to as a high priest, which means he is an intercessor. And we're going to, of course, read as we continue through this book that his intercessory work is perfect. Unlike the intercessory work of all the lineage, of all the priests of Aaron and all the priests of the Levites, who could never, through their animal sacrifices, could never finally accomplish completion or perfection on behalf of those people for whom they were interceding, Christ himself, one time, one sacrifice, one spilling of his blood, one acceptance of the wrath of God was sufficient to fully, completely, and eternally abate the wrath of God on behalf of all those that he was interceding for. So, let's start in chapter 5, verse 1. That was
all introduction.
Very, very good. I'm so glad I have an advocate in the room. Chapter 5, verse 1. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. So they know this. This is what a high priest does. This is definitional to the high priest job. The high priest stands between a holy God and sinful people, and he is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God. The chief difference in the Old Testament between prophets and priests is that prophets speak for God to people, whereas the priest intercedes on behalf of people to God. The big difference is God communicates, God speaks, God commands, God dispenses his rules and laws, God tells men things men don't know. The priest just goes back and says, I'm sorry. That's all the priest does. The priest is not there to argue. The priest isn't there to pose a defense for Israel. His job is completely go back and apologize, go back and take an animal, go back and sacrifice, go back and spill blood. So it's a very one-way conversation. God speaks to people through his prophets, but the priests go back to God and sacrifice to God in recognition of our sinfulness against a completely holy God. So every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. And he can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself is also beset with weakness. Now, this is going to be one of the big contrasts between all the Levitical priests and Jesus. All the Levitical priests were humans. They were all sinful. And as you may recall, we've gone through all of it in our Wednesday night studies as we worked our way through the Pentateuch verse by verse. So you can go back and listen to those studies on our website. But you may recall that one of the things that the high priest has to do on the Day of Atonement is he has to make sure that he's wearing all the proper gear, that he's got the gear. That's the word. That's the technical Hebrew word for what he was wearing. He had to have gear. He had to have the proper clothing, the proper robes, the proper turban. He had to have that plate on his chest in gold over his heart, the children of Israel. He had to have the stones on his shoulders with the 12 tribes of Israel, six on each shoulder, weighing him down. And he had to have that plate of gold on his head that said, Holiness to the Lord. And he had to have a proper sacrifice, and he had to go on the right day, and he had to have the right incense. He has to have stopped at the laver of cleansing and looked at his reflection in the brass and cleaned himself. He has to make sure that the candles are burning, and the first thing he has to do before he can go into the holiest place is he has to sacrifice for himself, because he has to be clean before he can go in and sacrifice for Israel. And that's what the writer of Hebrews is getting at, is that he himself was human. He was weak. He also needed sacrifice for himself. But because he was human, he could also be gentle. This is the only place in the New Testament where you find this particular word. And it has the word pathos right in it. He can be empathetic with our human condition because he's human. And so in the Levitical rules, there were sacrifices for sins of ignorance, things you did that you just didn't know any better, because God knows what humans are like. And he knows that sometimes people are going to break his laws, not intentionally, but they're going to do it. So there was even a sacrifice for that. And that sacrifice was done by the high priest, who would sacrifice on behalf of the ignorant, on behalf of the people who offended God by mistake. So he can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself is also beset with weakness. And because of that, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins as for the people, so also for himself. Verse 4, he says, No one takes the honor of high priest to himself. He receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. Back in the book of Exodus, when God called Moses, one of the things he told Moses was, I'm going to give you Aaron, your brother, to be your high priest. which is really interesting because that was God saying, I'll talk to you, Moses, but you're still going to need somebody to sacrifice for you, and it can't be you. So God was very purposeful in dividing up the responsibilities. The Old Testament has prophets. The Old Testament has priests. The Old Testament has kings. But no man ever achieved the status of prophet, priest, and king anywhere in the Old Testament. And yet in the book of Hebrews, Jesus is referred to as prophet, as priest, and as king. So all of those offices are representative offices pointing toward the Messiah to come, but no priest ever took the job to himself. No Israelite got to volunteer. You had to have a particular lineage. You had to be a descendant of Aaron. And even then, later on, God decided which particular lineage of Aaron's descendants were going to get the priesthood. And he went towards Zadok and he closed off other families and said, you'll never be priests. So it was always up to God to determine every year who the high priest was going to be. So now the writer of Hebrews tells us that in the exact same way, verse 5, also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become the high priest, but he who said to him, thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. That's actually Psalms 2:7. And that particular psalm, Psalms 2, has a long, rich history in Israel and was oftentimes read at the yearly celebration of the king. And the writer of Hebrews picks it up and says, that's speaking of Christ, the ultimate king, saying, you are my son, today have I begotten you. Now, that individuality, that sonship, is a really important aspect of Jesus' earthly ministry. In fact, when he was baptized, when he began to be 30 years of age and he went down to be baptized by John the Baptist, you might recall that the Spirit of God descended from heaven as a dove and it lighted on Jesus. And a voice from heaven spoke. And you remember what the voice said? You're right. The voice from heaven said, this is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased, hear him. In other words, just as the writer of Hebrews says when he opens his epistle, he says, in times past, in various places and at sundry times, God spoke by the prophets, but he has in these most recent days, in these last days, spoken to us by his son. And so this New Testament, New Covenant prophet and high priest and king is completely unique, and God himself took the time to say, that's my son, a unique son. Now, that's not the only time God said it. Do you remember where else God said that? The Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus took Peter, John, and James up onto a high mountain, and he was transfigured, and they saw a little bit of his glory. And it said that his clothing became blindingly white, and he was shining with this light, and standing beside him were Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. And Moses and Elijah were enough to convince Peter that now Moses, Elijah, and Jesus were on the same plane, same par. So Peter jumps right to it, good old Peter, it's always Peter. Peter jumps right on it and goes, it's good that we're here, Lord. Let us build three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses. Equate the three of them, and a voice comes from heaven and says, this is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased. And that voice causes the three of them to get down on their faces. The presence of God is there. And when they look up, only Jesus is standing there. And Moses and Elijah are gone. This is my son. Hear him. And so, you are my son, today have I begotten you, is said all the way back in Psalm 2, is picked up by the writer of Hebrews to once again demonstrate the uniqueness of Christ, not only from every man, but specifically from every high priest. Chapter 3, verse 1, he's already identified Jesus as the high priest, as the apostle of our profession. Now he's making sure that we understand that he's not like any other high priest. And one of the most valuable aspects of our new covenant high priest is that he ever lives to make intercession for us. Unlike all the human priests who would do their job and die, we have a high priest who sacrificed himself, a fully sufficient sacrifice, and now ever lives to intercede for us, so that not only are we forgiven for our sins, but even in those times when we are rebellious or fall short or are ignorant or sin against God, that same high priest continues to sit at the right hand of God, interceding for us on a continual basis. That's how saved we are. I like knowing that even in my worst moment, the best one is still sitting at the right hand of God, interceding for me personally.
Yes.
I'm really glad to know that, because he doesn't fail at what he's doing. Here, let me demonstrate how much he doesn't fail at what he's doing. Chapter 5, verse 6 says, just as he also says in another passage, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. There's the first place that he drops the Melchizedek name here in chapter 5. Like I said, he's going to pick it up in a couple chapters and explain the Melchizedek connection. If you want to know more about that, you just have to come back. In the days of his flesh, Christ offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one who was able to deliver him or save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. That's most likely a reference to Gethsemane. It's a reference to his intercessory work as our high priest, and that he, as a faithful high priest, prayed on our behalf. He interceded, and he offered up prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one who could deliver him from death. We have to understand that phrase. It doesn't mean that he was afraid of death. He knew he was going to come up out of the grave, and he wasn't asking God to deliver him from the possibility of physical death. It's bigger than that. He was praying to the one who he knew would deliver him from death, hell, and the grave, resurrect him, and bring him back to life. Is the typical Hebrew commentary on that passage. The understanding of it isn't just limited to Jesus was afraid to die. He's the Lord of glory and he knows he's going to resurrect again. He was interceding on our behalf to the one who he knew was going to deliver him from death. And he was heard because of his piety. That's a really interesting phrase, because he's a high priest who talks back. Unlike all the other high priests who only say, I'm sorry, and bring a sacrifice, he talked back to God, responded to God, had conversations with God throughout his ministry, was equal with God, and because he was righteous, he had the standing and the authority to have those conversations. That's why you and I don't get to have those conversations. That's why you and I don't get to burst into God's presence and think that he's going to be impressed just because you showed up. You don't get to stand in front of God and argue. Again, the book of Job is a very clear demonstration of that. Can you imagine what would happen to you? If you started mouthing off to God and saying, why, God, and why have you done this, and why have you done that? What if God did show up and started with, who is this that darkens my counsel without knowledge? You're not going to feel real good about yourself at that moment. But he has every right to tell you, be quiet. Who are you? I'm God. I know what I'm doing. I'm sovereign. I'm in the activity of glorifying myself and providing everything necessary for your full, complete, eternal redemption. What exactly is your complaint here? He has every right, like Paul said in Romans 9, when he says, you're going to say to me, how does he yet find fault, seeing as no one resists his will? Paul has just made the argument that God is going to be merciful to whom he'll be merciful to, and he'll harden who he'll harden. And then Paul assumes that you will ask the question, how is that fair? And Paul's answer, when you get to how is that fair, Paul's answer is, who are you? That's the continual response when human beings stand up on their hind legs and shake their fist at God. The answer from God's perspective is always, who are you? Where do you get the authority to talk back to me? Jesus, because he was perfect, because of his piety, because of his righteousness, he had the right, unlike any other high priest, to talk to God, have conversations with God. So, in his piety, he prayed on our behalf. He supplicated God. He did all the things that a high priest does. And verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. I just can't wrap my head around that. It's difficult to understand the concept of the eternal God, the Son, one part of the triunity, one part of the Godhead, all of this Bible language that attempts to explain and understand who we're dealing with here. That one came to earth, became human, and suffered physical torture unlike anything you or I will ever have to endure, and in doing so, learned obedience to the Father. I can't even fathom it outside of the idea that he was doing it as our substitute, that he was doing it as the captain of our salvation, that he was being perfect because we can't be perfect. I don't know how else to think about it. I don't know how else to conceive of the notion that the Son of God was somehow completed or learned obedience from the things that he suffered. But look at verse 9, and having been made perfect, that is a single Greek word, he'd been made perfect, and so he became, to all those who obey him, the source of eternal salvation. So where does eternal salvation come from? It comes from him. He's the source. Just like he is the author and finisher of our faith. Just like he is the captain of our salvation. Throughout the Bible, the only place you can find salvation is in him, because he's the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by him. But he became complete, the word perfect here. He was perfected. He had everything necessary to accomplish what he came here to accomplish. The end result of what he came to accomplish is when the writer of Hebrews uses this exact same Greek word, having been made perfect. He uses the same word in chapter 10. So turn there and let me show you something. Chapter 10 of the book of Hebrews. We're nearly done. I know it's warm. I said we were nearly done. How many of you believed me? Really, one. Thank you. Thank you. You two? Two of you. The rest know me so well, they go, yeah, nearly done. Yeah. I'm hot too. It's warm. Let's start in chapter 10, verse 8. After saying above, sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do your will. And he takes away the first in order to establish the second. And by this will, we have been sanctified. That's hagiosmos. That's the same word that is translated sanctified, holy, saint. All of those words are that same root, hagios, holy. We have been set apart for God's exclusive use through Christ's one single sacrifice on behalf of his people. But look at the outcome. By his will, we have been sanctified, set apart for God's exclusive use through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ one time, once for all. And every high priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But he, Christ, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. Look at verse 14. For by that one offering, he has perfected, same word in the Greek, he has perfected for all time those that he sanctified. So the ones that he set apart for God's exclusive use through his one-time sacrifice, those people are complete, perfect for all time as a result of the once-for-all-time sacrifice. So when Christ came and suffered, when he learned obedience to the Father and then was made perfect through the things he suffered, that perfection is imputed to us. Through his finished sacrifice, the perfection that Christ earned in that he was perfect, in that he was heard because of his righteousness, he achieved actual righteousness. Our righteousness is the result of his righteousness being placed on our account, which happens as a result of Christ's once-for-all finished sacrifice by which he perfected forever those that he set apart for God's exclusive use. Do you see how this whole perfection thing kicks in? Christ suffered, Christ lived the perfect life, Christ was sinless and perfect before God through his own merit, through his own work, through his own keeping of every rule and law, through his own perfect self-justification, if I can say that, through his own ability to be perfect before God throughout his whole lifetime. He earned that. He merited that status. None of us could. And so as a perfect high priest, he did what no other high priest could do. Instead of giving animal blood that could never take away sin, he gave his own blood, sacrificed himself, thereby perfecting forever all those for whom he died, and now is seated at the right hand of God, where he ever lives, to intercede for those people who he died for and sanctified. If you can't see security in that, if you don't feel really good once you know that, then something in you is broken and we need to have a talk. Because Christ has been stated over and over and over again in the New Testament, and now a Hebrew writing to Hebrews comparing him to the Old Testament priests comes back to that same theme that permeates the New Testament and the New Covenant. And that theme is Christ did absolutely everything necessary for your full, complete redemption and eternal salvation. And if you can get a hold of the phrase perfected forever, you can walk out of here feeling pretty good.
Yes.
Especially in light of the fact that, well, you're you. And you know your imperfections. And you know all the places you have failed. You don't even know all the places. You know some of the places you failed. You have a hint about what a failure you are before the righteous, eternal, holy God. And yet he devised a plan that he prefigured for 1,400 years through a whole series of human high priests sacrificing a continual flow of blood, all preaching the same message for 1,400 years, which is you're a sinner and you can't stand before God unless you have a sacrifice and an intercessor. And then he sent his son to be the sacrifice and the intercessor who did it all once for all. That's the foundation of the new covenant. That's why the old covenant is done away with its sacrifice and its priesthood and its inability to perfect people. But if you are in Christ and Christ is in you, then you are the recipient of that once-for-all sacrifice and you are perfected forever in the finished work of Christ. And if you aren't shouting hallelujah, at least in your head right now, then again, I don't know what to do for you. I know it's hot. I know we're all a little sweaty right now. But praise God for what he has done for us. When you get to the end of the day today and your head hits your pillow, take a moment and just one more time focus on what you heard this morning and say thank you. In fact, say thank you in the car on the way home.
Yes.
In fact, say thank you now. And just keep saying it because what he has done for you is all the stuff you could never, ever have done for yourself. And he did it all. You got it?
Yes.
Are there any questions about that?
Good news.
He was a first perfect man and he became a perfect sacrifice. God accepted his perfect sacrifice.
And that, Gladys, is a done deal. Right?
Right.
So by the way, if he did it all, what do you need to add to it?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Exactly. There's wisdom. All you get to add to it is thank you. That's all you got. So you can now give up on attempting to impress God with yourself. I'll save you the trouble. He's not impressed. He's impressed with his son. And we're accepted in the beloved. So run to Christ, trust Christ, and he, as your perfect intercessor, always lives to make sure that everything he did on your behalf comes to its fruition, which is eternal life for you. And it just doesn't get better than that. Now I'm done.
That was good.
Say goodbye to the internet people.
Bye.
See you next time.
Stay cool.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.